self-explanatory.
Good afternoon. I'm Chairman Brad Holton. I'll bring the meeting to order. We have a 3 o'clock agenda item for elections update. And we have Secretary of State calling in on WebEx. And do we have the elections equipment manufacturer dialed in? It's unidentified to me.
He couldn't make it.
He couldn't make it, okay. All right, perfect. So with that, let's get started. I understood that there was another LNA ran this morning. How did that go? Or was there one?
No, so, thank you. The LNA has been rescheduled.
Okay.
So we're gonna be running the LNA on Thursday at 6:30, this upcoming Thursday, 6:30 PM. In our office, same place.
Okay, good. Well, sounds good. All right, so we had sent out some questions and we were going to want to do that. Is there any opening remarks that Phil, that you'd like to make or the clerk before we get started?
Well, for starters, welcome Phil, can you hear us? Thank you. Okay, well, we'll just start in if that's all right. And Haley and Brandy put together these documents that are in front of you and address the questions that we received Friday. So you two would want to start
absolutely.
In on that?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a first for us, our office, to report all this stuff. So it's kind of exciting. So thank you for the opportunity, and I appreciate that. So on page one, you'll notice this is numbers for early voting broken down by date as well as by location. So Caldwell is obviously our election office, and then HCC is the Hispanic Cultural Center. And then it tells you the totals for each day, and then at the bottom, how many voters in each location have voted so far with a total number added there. The other two diagrams there are just some neat little facts that I put together just for this election, so we can look at trends and how many people are voting here versus Hispanic, things like that. Any questions on that data?
Thank you.
Okay. On page two, we have, these are absentees sent out versus what's been returned. As of this morning, I wanna say it was like 10:30 this morning. Obviously, as the mail comes in and they keep scanning that number, that return ballot is going to increase, so.
If we could back up.
Yeah.
At the Cultural Center in Nampa, drove out there the other day, and the way everything's situated, the signage was, I felt like, subpar. So we worked with, did we get some sandwich boards
mm-hmm.
out there?
I believe they're on their way out.
They're
this
on
time.
Their way.
Yes.
Okay, to improve, you know, the turnout is disappointing as far as early voting goes, so we're hoping to pick that up.
Yes.
Are there other copies, Haley, that you have available for people in the audience that are wanting to
have
follow?
One left. Well, I gave them to him. Do you want to make copies if somebody's willing to make more copies? I brought 11 and I thought I'd have enough.
There you go. Whoops, I wrote them.
Thank you.
No, I thought I brought enough.
Zach, had you written them?
Yeah.
Yep. We have a habit of making the notes.
Yeah.
Here's one that's never been written.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Are we good to continue? Okay. So question number three, which asked about poll worker status and are the elections adequately staffed, you'll notice there the first two numbers. So poll workers needed for this election was 380. We currently have 299. It's been pretty tough getting the adequate number of polling or poll workers that we needed. However, With the shortage, we have listened to some advice from other Idaho counties as well as the Secretary of State himself. And due to all of our polling locations being ADA compliant, we are not required by law to have curbside voting, which actually reduces the amount of people we need to staff a polling location. Every time there is a curbside voter, it takes two staff members outside during that voting process. So if we have three cars out there trying to curbside, you lose six staff members that could be potentially inside working. So we have removed curbside voting for election day. However, we are staffed and able to do so for curbside on for early voting at both locations. So we will have and have been having curbside for early voting at local locations at this time.
The $299, does that include the student poll workers?
No, that does not.
How many student poll workers?
So, Chairman, Commissioners, every election I try to coordinate with local school districts to a lot of the students who are in their senior year have to get their volunteer hours in order to graduate. I send out the notices. However, Caldwell High School is one of the main participants in this. They look forward to it every year. And I had 57 students sign up, and they went through the full training just like every other poll worker would. And they are going to be staffed throughout the county. Law requires that there's only two per location or per precinct that in on a team. And we were able to get those. So the students are going to be a huge help out there in the polls.
Good.
Okay.
All right.
So next question, number four, polling locations. Any issues with equipment or accommodations? Accommodations, not necessarily. There's a slight issue, but it's getting worked out. But on Monday, which was October 23rd, when we opened the polls, we noticed that the scanner in the Hispanic Cultural Center, for whatever reason, was not working. We could not figure out why. We sent out our technical administrator to do some troubleshooting on it and ended up having to replace the machine while they were out there. During that time frame, though, they were able to still cast their ballot. They just had to put it in what we call a curbside slot on the side for it to be scanned when the scanner was up and running. So voting didn't take a stop at that point. Just had to replace the scanner, and we're looking further into that scanner as to why it wasn't working out as expected. And then on Wednesday, October 25th, at the Hispanic Cultural Center, we noticed that upon my arrival, it was freezing in the building, and everybody was wrapped in blankets and coats. Come to find out, the Hispanic Cultural Center has lost all heating. The HVAC system is down and was supposed to be down for 3 weeks, which was concerning not only for the voters and the staff, but also because the election equipment has to be temperature controlled. The gentleman out there, I believe his name is Dan Martinez, works for the city. Wonderful gentleman, brought out a bunch of space heaters, so we were able to keep the space warm. My understanding is they are currently working on it, and it should be up and fixed by election day. Keeping my fingers crossed, though, on that one.
One more issue at the Cultural Center was the drop box where those ballots were deposited. Is that a secured drop?
Yes.
Okay, and then was there a reconciliation of the number of voters and the number of ballots that were cast?
Yes. So based on the number of check-ins we had on the e-poll books, that matched with the number of papers or ballots that were deposited into the curbside.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. All right. So number five. Coordination status, are communications from Secretary of State, local cities, local taxing districts consistent and clear? There's a brief just explanation there. We work very closely with the Secretary of State's office. Thank you, by the way. We also have been trying to build communications and bridges with a lot of our local taxing districts. We're trying to build communication a little bit better, trying to get out and help those cities. Teach them a little bit about their upcoming elections. It's a process. Some of them are hard to get a hold of. However, we are trying to build that and grow on that a little bit more for outreach. Okay, good. No questions? Okay, so the wait times. So number six, plan to reduce wait times on election day. This is, I love statistics myself, and so I like to look back on what we did and what happened over the elections from the last few years. And in 2021, we held a very similar election. So you have your municipal races, your school district trustees, fire district commissioners, cemetery district, I think they're called supervisors, forgive me if I'm wrong, as well as bonds and levies, and then a city bond on this election. And looking back into 2021, at that time, we were very well into that pandemic, and we only had 13 polling locations open, which was scary and rough. We have been able to build that to 37 for this election, so I definitely believe that is going to reduce the lines compared to what we saw in 2021. Addition to that, we are really pushing absentee voting as much as possible. And you can see by the numbers, we've sent out over 5,000 absentee ballots. And then really, really, really pushing for in-person early voting. We're not seeing the numbers we'd like to see there. However, you know, there's still time. We've got 4 days left after today. So I'm not going to give up yet. Any questions?
What numbers were you hoping for?
So the amount of eligible voters for this election is just over 99,000. I was hoping for at least 10%. I don't think we're going to reach that, unfortunately. Do you want to talk about the number seven? Okay, for number seven, the status of the security upgrade. So we were able to obtain the updated quotes from HART. When I requested those, that was during budget time in May. They expire after 30 days, so we needed an updated quote. Me and the clerk have to sit down now that we're both back and healthy and not sick, so we can discuss the equipment purchase side of it. And we are just waiting also for the approval of 2.7, which is projected to be approved beginning of 2024. We checked with Dan at the state, and they're looking into it, and they said it shouldn't be an issue, but beginning of 2024. So that way we can do both 2.7 upgrade for the HART equipment along with the Windows 10 upgrade prior to the upcoming elections once this one's complete.
Bullet point addressed on page 4 under security, equipment security upgrade. Is this the first upgrade that's been available to run on that? I guess I'm confused.
So for the upgrade, there's two parts of it. So with 2.3, it operates under Windows 7. And so the cost for the upgrade is actually to upgrade the Windows portion to Windows 10. The second section, which is called the HART 2.7, for lack of better terms currently, that is the software version on the HART equipment. That is actually at no cost. There was 2.5, and then I think a couple little additions after that that has gone through since we've obtained 2.3 when we purchased the equipment. But because we didn't have Windows 10, that wasn't eligible for us to upgrade to that software.
Was it a choice not to upgrade to Windows 10, or that Windows 10 wasn't available?
For 2.5 or currently?
Maybe you can help me, Chief. I'm not IT. That's not my thing. But
I get one there too.
For a Windows version that were available for purchase. Mm-hmm. Why did we not purchase that to get the upgrade from 2.3?
I did request it in the budget. However, it did not go through until this year, but it was in my previous budgets as a request to upgrade to Windows 10.
Okay. That on the certification by the state, and maybe this is for Secretary of State, help me understand, because there's a lot of emphasis, and I know that the Secretary McGrane has an interest in elections integrity, as do the rest of us, but how do you certify that, and how to help us have confidence as a voting population where we don't have a certified system yet.
Is your question addressed? So Secretary, go ahead, Secretary.
Okay, thanks. And Commissioners, thank you for allowing our office to participate. I think we'll have more just on the certification process. I think to your question, Commissioner Van Beek, a couple of things. So all of the systems used by Canyon County are certified systems. Counties are not permitted to use a system unless it has been certified by the Secretary of State's office. Preceding our office's certification process, all systems used in Idaho must be certified by the United States Election Assistance Commission. That's the federal agency that oversees election equipment and election administration. We work with them in terms of what the available systems are. So any of the vendors doing business in Idaho will first go through that federal certification, then also perform a certification testing here. I think it's worth noting the systems that we're talking about, these are the systems that design and tabulate the ballots. These systems at no point are ever connected to the internet. They are also hardened systems, so even the discussion of Windows 7 versus Windows 10, these aren't the same as like a county networked PC. There are different elements to this. They have restricted use by the software vendors, which is tested. The tests that have been mentioned are both partially security related as well as functionality related. So each one, they do go through multiple iterations, as I think was kind of alluded to. There will be different points in time. So we will, in many instances, have, you know, as many as like two certifications a year for a specific vendor related to those systems that we'll go through. And so part of this is just forecasting forward as they develop new upgrades or patches to anything that becomes known as a potential threat. We're working with them to go through that certification process.
Thank you, Secretary.
So I believe we are on, yes, number 8. So Chairman, Commissioners, the election website. This is a hot topic. Our election website is, to put it nicely, very subpar. We've had several complaints from local taxing districts, cities, as well as the voting public about our website. We agree. We dislike it very much as well. We want it to be clearer to the public and just a little user-friendly is what we're going for. I have talked to the Secretary of State's office as well as Clerk Yamamoto and moving forward with making some big changes, completely knocking it down and starting from the ground up. That's with the Secretary of State's office and kind of building better blocks. I have a meeting with Nick Toves after this election sometime in December to go over this with him further, and then coordinating with the state at that point to really wipe the slate clean and make it easier for our constituents in Canyon County.
Yes. So what I heard you say is that the elections office is the directly responsible party for content.
To an extent. There's a few things. So Kylie Marks, our technical administrator in the office, she's able to change minor things on the website. However, we don't have control over it. Somebody in IT does, so we have to ask to have things put on and changed or modified. We don't have control over our website at this time.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Van Beek, to expand on that, is IT will create the framework of what the page will look like, and then within the page, that officer, that department can actually change the content within that framework. So it is a partnership between IT, and in this case, the elections office, to make sure that something is actually out there that's usable. This is one area that I know IT, for a fact, has been wanting to change for a long time. So this is a good opportunity to partnership and redo it.
So tools, and then somebody using the tools.
Correct. So IT is responsible for providing the tools, and then the office of the department is, it's in their vein to make sure that that tool's outfitted with the right information.
The Secretary has a question.
Yes. Go ahead, Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry, it's a little awkward, obviously, being remote. One thing I might add just to this piece of the conversation, I don't know that the elections team is fully aware, but our office is currently in the process of doing some major upgrades to the voteidaho.gov website. VoteIdaho.gov serves, and hopefully in the future will even serve more, as a one-stop shop for voters throughout the state. So whether it's a Canyon County voter or a Boundary County voter, voters can go there, register to vote, check their voting status. One of the things we're working on for an election like the one coming up here on November 7th is for voters to be able to look up and see what they're eligible to vote on. I think that's probably one of the questions that's coming up with an election of this nature. It unfortunately won't be available for this coming election, but our anticipated launch is at the very beginning of the next calendar year. Hopefully provide more resources so that each of the 44 counties aren't having to do the heavy lifting for all of this in terms of coordination. So I just thought that might fit within this. And it, even to the elections team there, they haven't seen any upgrades yet.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll take the next question. Transition from a previous county PIO to the new constituent services office. So I have met with Greg Rath, Rick Hogeboon, and the sheriff, and what we wish to do is have a joint effort. For right now, we would like to keep Joe working with Rick to make this transition, and probably through the 24 primary. Joe does a lot of various things for us, and there's quite a few things to learn, but I have zero problem with Rick being part of that as we make this transition.
Sounds reasonable.
Yes.
And the person that we're missing here would be the sheriff. We have not met with him regarding this, but there was an agreement that when a constituent services was brought on board, that transition would happen because Joe is valuable to the sheriff's office. So I think that I can't answer that question.
I talked to the sheriff Friday, and he said, let's continue with the plan. He's totally good with the plan of having both people working on this through the May primary.
All right, so the next question brought up was number 10, and this is the LNA testing. Unfortunately, I was not able to be present during the LNA testing. I was training many a poll worker during the time. However, I kind of put together data. Haley could probably speak on it more than I could. So during the logic and accuracy test that was performed on October 20th, all LNAs, or logic and accuracy tests, are open to the public. We do encourage people to come and be a part of it. They are held prior to each election, and just depends on when we can get it scheduled around early voting and training and meetings, and that's when we try to get it in. But the purpose of this test is really to ensure that the scanner or the equipment is reading the ballots correctly. As they are marked. That is the main purpose of the LNA test. And I was informed that during the LNA test, there was a request for an external photocopy to be introduced, which did cause some confusion to our staff. And we did reach out to the vendors through HART, and then also to the Secretary of State to get some clarity on some information that we just misunderstood. And we learned that it's doing exactly what it's supposed to. And Guillermo here from the Secretary of State can speak a little bit more on the LNA, as he has more depth knowledge on what it's supposed to do and what's required for that, for the LNA.
Phil's got a question.
Oh, yeah.
Staff could answer many of the other questions. There's a couple of things regarding the logic and accuracy test. As Brandy mentioned, the purpose of it is to help demonstrate that the equipment is doing what it's supposed to in terms of scanning. It's also to help build confidence in the elections process. I think given some of the questions and assertions made regarding the equipment previously, I think that was raised into question. I know I've spoken with Clerk Yamamoto, and as he mentioned at the outset, they're intending to do a new public logic and accuracy test coming up. I think at a high level, it's worth noting, you know, our office is involved in helping not only provide guidance and assistance here in Canyon County, but we have 42 other counties hosting elections for city council members and school district trustees coming up. We want to make sure that the public can have confidence in our systems. We already previously discussed certification processes that go through. I think in this case, I want to answer some public questions and maybe questions of yours regarding the equipment used. So our InterCivic is the vendor currently used in Canyon County. I think there was some misunderstanding, unfortunately, with the election staff and how the equipment was set up leading up to the public logic and accuracy testing, specifically regarding the what's called the use of unique identifiers. This is the term unique identifiers is a term provided by HART, their internal terms. The system as it was programmed for this upcoming election does not use unique identifiers, meaning each ballot image is a similar image. They're the same image, you know, in terms of if all the contents are the same, it's a ballot type, that ballot is going to be the same for each voter. If the protocols in terms of reconciliation, I know Commissioner Van Beek, you asked about that related to early voting, that same reconciliation should be happening in all phases throughout the election. To verify the number of check-ins matches the number of ballots and working through that. I know that there have been questions related to that as well. Our office has taken an active involvement here to assist the Canyon County team. Guillermo and Megan are, I believe they're in the room with you, although I can't see them. They've been assisting, just kind of looking at some of the processes, and will continue to be assisting throughout this election and answering questions where we can. Specific to the equipment here, though, one of the things, so some counties who use HART InterCivic, so all the largest counties except for Kootenai County are using HART as their main vendor, so including Ada, Bonneville, Bonner County. The use of unique identifiers is what I believe in past conversations with HART led some people to believe that a photocopied ballot would not necessarily be read. It is possible to program the equipment so that is the case, and that there is a unique number assigned to each ballot. I will say, as Secretary, I have some hesitation, and there are pros and cons to each of these systems. Specifically, Idaho's Constitution, Article 6, Section 1, guarantees a secret ballot. And when we start adding unique numbers and identifiers to the ballot, that causes me pause in terms of whether we would be able to trace back someone's votes and how they are cast. So it's something we are trying to work through guidance. It's guidance that has not been issued under my predecessors. And we're working with that. But the machines, as they were programmed, I have every reason to believe, worked properly, and a photocopy ballot would be read. I will say from my past experience, I could have, I knew that that was the case here in this instance. It's possible in future elections to program it differently if that's how the county prefers to do. And both HART and our office are able to assist and guidance on that. But as the equipment is programmed for this election, it is scanning, I believe, properly to what it should, that the known outcomes that were put into the machine reading the ballots match the known results that should be reported out. I think here in terms of safeguards, that statutorily there are other elements, whether it's watermarking or official ballot stamps, that are also added protocols to this step. I think our office has had conversations with the election team there to help work through it. We will be assisting through the public logic and accuracy test later this week. I'm happy to answer any of the questions, but I know that certainly the logic and accuracy test conducted on the 20th has raised some questions. And our office wants to provide any support we can to assist the county moving forward.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Secretary. I appreciate that information. I did call and talk to the Bonneville County. It's my understanding that they use the unique identifier, And they confirmed that and indicated that they've run during their logic and accuracy test, tried to duplicate, run a duplicate ballot through that, and it rejected it. So I guess a couple of questions that might, I understand there's pros and cons, but it might give on the positive side some more assurance for the voters that, because that seems to be making the news, oh, a duplicate ballot was accepted. So how many counties currently in the state of Idaho are using the unique identifier? And then have you had any complaints from those counties that are using that that would complain that they didn't have anonymity?
Commissioner Van Beek, in terms of the counties, I believe there are two counties using the unique identifiers. I think, as we previously discussed, like Ada County isn't. They're giving to the trade-off, so as a security, being able to prevent a ballot from being read twice, certainly there's strong advantages to that. But there are also other things. So, for example, in most major elections, Canyon County has shifted to using a secured printer to be able to send and mail absentee ballots. That would not be an option using the unique identifiers. Similarly, printing ballots on demand for absentee ballots or others, which adds the assurance of making sure the right ballot is issued, wouldn't be available in the same way. Different equipment is interacting different with each other. I mean, I can get into the weeds to a certain degree, but there are trade-offs. In terms of unique identifiers, it is a tough one, and I will say nationally since the 2020 election, being able to uniquely identify ballots, there's a strong desire by many to be able to do that. It would be similar to like a serial number on a dollar bill. The challenge is, again, being able to identify how someone voted in the constitutional protections we have. And there's not an easy call. I can say as a security step, it certainly helps, but as the administrative side and the secrecy side, there's offsets. That's why we see different counties making different decisions related to it. I can easily say as the clerk, former clerk in Ada County, when we ran elections, we were able to reconcile through the process to make the election system work smoothly. And I can say for this upcoming election, Ada County is not using unique identifiers, but is providing other security measures and steps. I think this is a decision for the county clerk's office is to figure out what works best. Our office wants to help make sure it's working properly. Our office also plays the role for when we get into the general election year where we will come through and be doing audits of the elections to make sure that the official ballots are the ballots that are counted, as well as that the results that we find through the audits match the publicly reported results that the county has reported.
Chairman.
Yes.
Thank you. That sounds like a great plan. I do have a question as a segue off of that. What you're saying would work and ensure the anonymity, provided that the reconciliation sheets that are supposed to be filled out by the senior judges are completed, reconciling the number of spoiled ballots, the number of registered voters, and the number of ballots cast, correct? So that becomes really an integral part of training and making sure that those senior judges are trained to fill those out. Otherwise, you really don't have control on that factor. Is that right?
Commissioner Van Beek, that's in part. I think you're right in terms of the need for training to make sure that the judges are completing the process. I think in your particular instance, and this is true throughout most of the state, is the utilization of the electronic poll books. Beyond the work that the poll workers are doing, those electronic poll books are creating records for reconciliation and other things to be able to audit. I'm a big advocate of the electronic poll books because of the additional data and information it allows to ensure that things are working properly, and I think to the heart of your question as well, to ensure that poll workers are following the proper steps. That's always a challenge when you look at the size of the workforce that's used. Throughout the state, almost 5,000 poll workers are used in a major election, and that's a lot of different people to train to make sure they're getting each step right, and so things like the electronic poll books help serve as a tutorial to help get compliance, but also to provide that essential data for things like verifying that the number of voters who came up and checked in and showed their ID aligns and matches that with the number of ballots that have been cast, and that if we see any variance that we can investigate and try and determine why or if there were any problems with an election. Elections are a major lift and exercise, I think, as you guys have discussed and probably seen from your own experiences, but it's important to ensure that we do have accurate results.
Chairman, follow up. So what I heard you say is that there's a two-step process for verifying the reconciliation process, the e-poll book, and then the actual data sheets that are manually filled out.
I guess the simple version is there is data being captured above and beyond what the poll workers are filling out to help ensure that reconciliation occurs.
Thank you.
If we could go a little bit deeper there, the unique identifier sounds like a great idea right up until you start looking in at what the mechanics are involved. So I don't care who answers this question, but let's take another little deeper dive there.
I can definitely take it on. After speaking with the Secretary of State and their experience with those who use unique identifiers, for example, this election, our first mailing, we sent over 3,000 ballots. It took us a day and a half to print those from our printer. And if we used unique identifiers, we would have to print one ballot at a time instead of saying, print 70 of this, now print 20 of these. It would be literally one ballot at a time. So our printing would go from a day and a half to more than a week. And we have deadlines that don't allow for that type of time frame. In the larger elections for May and November next year, especially when we have several more thousand absentees to go out, we'll never meet our deadlines, unfortunately, if we have those unique identifiers on the ballot, because we can only print one ballot at a time. We would not be able to use the company that we do for printing because they're not able to print one ballot at a time. So it goes back to, yes, it might work for those smaller counties, but those larger counties, us being the second largest in the state, there's not a way around it that we would be able to meet our deadlines to get those absentees out in time.
So that addresses absentees. What would it look like at the duo and with in-person voting?
So with the duo, as somebody is going in and voting, it is going to have that unique identifier on it when they cast their ballot. I mean, here's you've got your give and take with this. You're going to be able to cast your ballot, and nothing copied could be then cast behind it if somebody were to take it home and photocopy it. However, upon audits, we would, or somebody doing a public records request, would then be able to, oh, I see they were the third person checking in. They're the third person's, you know, the third ballot deposited. They would be able to tie your vote to you. And then again, what Secretary McGrane stated is that your ballot is no longer secret. And that goes against the Constitution. And so that's tough.
Yes.
If I may, one of the things I think might be important here for the conversation, while our office isn't necessarily advocating one way or the other, I want to make sure people are making informed choices. But also, this may be a good conversation to have a more thorough conversation after the election. The decision whether to use or not to use is something that has to be made well in advance of the election. About programming and the programming of the equipment takes place effectively just after candidate filing in the process. It's too late to make a change for the November 7th election. We do have a time gap following this election, and given some of the questions that the logic and accuracy test has raised, the questions here, I think, you know, it's warranted for the elections team to have further conversations with HART, as well as for you guys to be able to get some more of your questions answered. But it may be a conversation that is best at a future date.
Okay, so it sounds like unless the board wants to dwell upon it, let's move on. Okay.
That sounds good.
All right.
So, Chairman, Commissioners, I do want to add, and there's some information here in the bottom on page 5, just some of the safety measures that we have in place to ensure that somebody doesn't try to sneak in a photocopied ballot. We have somebody stationed there at the scanner at all times. If they allow somebody to deposit two ballots, that should raise question. I certainly wouldn't allow it, and my poll workers know better than to allow stuff like that. So they're watching things like that, so something to keep in mind, and then also the accounting procedures with the reports that we run and being able to check those all sources to make sure that everything balances correctly.
So I have I have a procedural question. Every time that I voted, I've taken my ballot, I check it for accuracy, and I walk over to the scanner and I place it into the machine. Mm-hmm. I don't have another opportunity to grab my ballot again.
No.
So under this scenario that you have duplicate of ballots, where are they getting the duplicate? I'm trying to go through the logic of where this, are we chasing a problem that doesn't physically exist?
Chairman, yes, actually I'm going to admit that that's the truth. If somebody were to leave with their ballot, fine, they don't have to they don't have to deposit their ballot. However, when they return, you're gonna have to get through several different people before you can get back to the scanner again in order to cast your ballot and the copied version. I just don't see that it's possible without somebody catching you saying, wait a minute, you were here earlier, or you know, you didn't check in. That's what we have the staff there for. They're watching and ensuring that you're going through the entire process. So if somebody just randomly comes in, number one, my poll workers aren't doing their job, and that's unfortunate, but I've never had this happen. We go through 20 days after the canvas, we go through and we stack everything up and get ready to throw it into retention. Never once have we seen an odd ballot in our ballot boxes. They all match the same duo paper that we've always used. We've never seen anything funky along those lines. To add to that also is a lot of people bring up absentees. And well, somebody could just copy their absentee. And certainly, they absolutely could. However, in our office, when we receive absentees back after they've gone through their thorough investigation, if we see that an envelope has two ballots in it, neither of them get counted. They just ruined their opportunity to vote because they tried to sneak something in an envelope that doesn't belong to them. So I encourage voters, if it's a husband and wife and they vote, don't put your ballots in the same envelope. They know it specifically says that on the instructions. You know, they have their own ballot, it's their own vote. So even then, if somebody were to copy an absentee, it is then voided at that time, and we don't count either one of them. We don't know which one to count at that time. Okay. So moving on, we're on to page 6. This goes over spoiled ballots, and this was a tough one because there's so many different ways. When you say spoiled ballots, I gave the top three scenarios here because there's several different ways we can do things in the system, but I don't think you guys really want to get into the weeds of that. So one of the options is when a voter checks into the e-poll book, if they get halfway through, get a phone call, they need to leave, or they decide to not vote that instance or not at all, the poll worker could then go into the e-poll book and spoil their check-in. So it's not a ballot at that point, it's just they're checking in. We're saying, never mind, they don't want to check in. So we can uncheck them in at that point, to where they could come back later and decide to vote at that time. The other scenario is an absentee. So if a voter were to get an absentee in the mail, they could come into their polling location if they decide to do so and vote in person or during early voting. So the system is aware through connection whether that person has been sent an absentee or not. It actually comes up on that e-poll book and asks if the voter is wanting to spoil their absentee. If they do so, you select the button that says yes, they're spoiling, they want to vote in person, and it completely spoils it from all of the systems in Canyon County. I think even at the state level, but they'd have to answer that question. It's completely removed, and then they can go ahead and vote in person. So if they were to vote in person and then try to sneak into our office to deposit a ballot, it's going to come up and tell them that they've already voted and that we can't accept it. So that's why everything talks to one another, and it works in our office.
Yeah, well, I had a question, which is a little bit related to page 6, but back on page 5,
yeah.
I'm struggling because what I heard was if people are in line, that the polls don't close until everybody in line has had a chance to vote.
Correct.
But the information on your website says that all ballots have to be received by 8 p.m. at a certain day. So that seems incongruous. How do you reconcile that?
Thank you for the question. That's actually a good one. I've never had that one before. So anybody in the polls, in the polling locations, if you have a line buildup and it's 8 o'clock, everybody that was in line by 8 p.m. can still cast their ballot, and that's per Idaho state code. Anybody that is dropping off their absentee, law states that all absentees must be deposited or returned to the Canyon County Elections Office by 8 p.m. or their deposit, wherever it is, depending on their county. I've never seen it. However, if we had a line, I'm assuming, outside the door for people waiting to deposit their absentee, then anybody that was in line to deposit their absentee by 8 p.m., they would be able to deposit it. Anybody that showed up at 8:01, would then, they're too late, unfortunately. And I do request that poll workers go to the end of the line to ensure nobody sneaks other members into the line, because we know that happens. So we do send somebody out to watch that line to ensure nobody gets it added to that line. Of course. And I think we were on the third option there, which if a voter makes a mistake on the ballot, it's as long as it's not deposited into the scanner or the ballot box, then it can always be fixed. It can always be spoiled. You can get reissued another ballot. But the second it goes into that box, we can't retrieve it. We can't do anything about it. That's why ensuring that the voter checks their ballot and makes sure that everything's accurate, as you know, is very, very important. And so if at that time they notice a decision that they want to change or a mistake on their ballot, they can always go back. What happens is we write spoiled on the actual ballot itself, and we keep those in a folder that gets returned to us on election night, so we're able to look at those. And then the voter would then be issued another ballot to vote on. Okay. Right. Interdepartmental coordination, this one's a tough one to discuss on, mostly because election timelines are tough, to say the least. Sometimes we're given 24 hours before we have to finalize something, and there's just not the time to wait on a staff member from another department to get started with that. So I think the IT has done a fantastic job with our crazy, awkward timelines that were thrown at us through Idaho State Code. I couldn't ask for anything better given what they have to deal with and what we have to deal with. And I think the best option we have is moving forward with the GIS analyst, which we're in the process of writing up that job description still at this time. So hopefully we'll get that done sometime soon.
That sometime soon, but realistically, is it for the 24 election? Is it for, it's obviously not for next week.
Oh, unfortunately, no. Thank you for the question. So the GIS position is, even if we were to post it today, with the election coming up, going through the interviewing process and finding somebody qualified, I don't necessarily see that we're going to get that prior to next week. So we're definitely looking at, you know, a May 2024. If we can get somebody way before then, that would be great. We're also looking at some of the language for the GIS analyst. I'm having some of the IT members review it. There's some language in there that I don't really understand or know if it's something that should be required on their job description, because I don't know how it would apply to us or elections. So I have several entities looking at it to see what needs to be put in there or what can be removed from that job description.
IT is in very capable hands with the now repurposed COO, and I had the opportunity to visit with Director Higgins last week, and I know that they are professionals who are ready and willing to assist, and so those are the right places for questions on the job descriptions. Thank you.
Then, Mr. Chair, there's two GIS analyst positions that were approved for FY24, one in the assessor's office, one in the elections and the clerk's office. We're looking at going out to market at the same time for both positions, so that way we have the same type of resume and receipt, so we can get these things filled. So there is a plan for it.
Could you, for the public, enumerate what GIS means to an elections staff? How does it interlock? How does it interface for the public so they can understand?
I'll see if I can do my best in explaining this, Chairman. So GIS, and Greg, you might be better, and what is geospatial
information systems?
Information systems, thank you. So we use a program that uses, it's mapping on the 10th degree, layers upon layers, so data that comes from the state, school districts, the State Board of Education, all of the district boundaries through the State Tax Commission all get layered upon layers of all their different boundaries. Well, those boundaries are tax code areas. So those tax code areas is what you pay taxes on. It's what you're taxed on where in the area that you live. They're broken down into tiny, tiny little pieces and parts that we call splits through the elections process. And a split in a precinct that you live in is what you pay taxes on or where you live geographically and how you should be able to vote. And so there's really not any other system out there that operates like this other than elections where we're having to break down extra pieces and geographically locate where a voter or an address is to give them the correct ballot. I hope that explains it the best I can.
So for the public, for Canyon County, we have in excess of 60 political subdivisions, and that's within the county. And some of those political subdivisions originate outside of the county. CUNA school district or a fire district could be outside of this county but go inside this county as a taxing district. So you have over 60 of those. And then you have combinations of overlying. So somebody that's in the CUNA Fire District is not going to have any taxes or any concern about the Homedale area, even though Homedale is in a different county. So you end up with all of these overlays of all of these districts. And if I remember right, doesn't it come out to like 167 separate taxing entities that a house could be in? In other words, if I was going to print out a unique ballot for the county, you would end up with at least in excess of 200 different ballots for those different overlays that a house or a property owner can be in that gets to vote.
Yeah, so Chairman, that actually, if you duplicate that number times three, because we also have to take in consideration of school zones that aren't typically involved with the TCAs or the tax code areas overlapping. And then also you have now the Nampa City Council districts that are divided up. So that's another addition on top of that. So I would love to count them. Maybe one day I will. but it's well over. We have just one precinct that has well over 80 different splits or tax code areas or ballot. That would be different ballot options. And that's just one. Yep. One precinct. Yeah.
Okay. Just so the public can have a little sense of a flavor of what we're up against to get you your ballot for your address is not as quite as straightforward and simple as it might seem.
You're correct, Chairman. I wish it was easy, but it's definitely
we ran into more problems this go round with some annexation and de-annexation, and that wasn't maybe too bad, but where we really had trouble was with some school district lines that did not match up. And so we spent the spring and summer working on that, and we basically had two school districts come in, I don't know, in August, mm-hmm. and kind of hash it out. They agreed to what the lines were, but there's some disagreement with the State Board of Education because they think that that was codified, for lack of the right word, but it was not. So that, and by the way, are we down to just one now, or is it still four, where the school district actually cuts the house in half?
Hope that doesn't cause a divorce.
So to add on to what Clerk Yamamoto was saying, yes, during this whole process of GISing everything, there are, I believe it is, 4 houses, one that is currently occupied, hallelujah, but there are 4 houses that are a parcel that is split directly in half. They have 2 different taxing districts, 4 school district, and it's literally 50% this tax district, 50% this tax district, and the house is in the middle. And so I did send the letter to the individual that lives on the property that's currently there and said, I don't know what you want to do, but you might have to pick which school district you're going to vote on. Because at that point, I'd reached out to Caldwell, Dave Marston, through the city of Caldwell to ask him some questions. I had talked to several entities in the county, and everybody kind of went, that's how it is, but I can't do that with elections because I can't separate a parcel into 2. It's 1 address, and it doesn't work in our system. So, yeah, there's a lot of difficulties.
And then if I might add, Chairman, when it comes to the process with GIS tied into elections, GIS, you're looking at the mapping. And so that's based off your layers and you have the tax code areas. But then once that map is done, we still have to go into the statewide voter registration system and update each individual street range with the information from the GIS mapping. So the mapping's 1 section, and then it goes to a whole other section within the elections data. And all of that has to be done prior to setting up an election to ensure that everybody who is eligible is in the accurate split, which is tied to the tax code area, and everything is set and correct.
I see the assessor still here. I'd like to call him out, thank him, actually. When we worked with the school districts, Brian Tender showed up and helped us out with that, and that was a huge help.
Good. It takes a whole team to do this. The other confusion that I've ran into is when you're split, as you call it, but a precinct or an area that a voter would call, if during like this type of election where there's not countywide races, like you could have an unopposed city council election and nothing else going on in that precinct, so there is no voting going to be done in that precinct because they were unchallenged races. And so per new state code, there's no need to show up to vote. So that's going to be a little confusing to a few people this fall, as they're going to want to get out to vote, and there's no place to vote for because there's no races in that specific area.
Chairman, you are correct. There's a lot of confusion when it comes to the areas people can vote or what is contested on the ballot. As you said, if it's uncontested, then there's nothing to vote for, so we don't put it on a ballot. But the other issue that we're seeing is a lot of people don't know where they live or what they pay taxes on. Do they live in School Zone 4? For instance, Valley View School Zone 4 is the only thing on the ballot for Valley View. Well, if you don't live in School Zone 4, you may think you have something to vote on. There's a lot of confusion. And then you add NAMPA going to the city council districts now, where people think that they can just vote because it's city council. But you actually have to live in city council seat either 2, 4, or 6 to vote on that specific council district. So there's a lot of confusion, and I don't know how to fix that. If you guys have any suggestions, I am all ears.
That's where the Secretary of State ran for office, right? Clear this all up. Okay. Any other comments on that?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And I just wanted to tell the public as well, as we have an application on the clerk's website under elections called Voter Lookup. So you can actually put in your address. It brings up all the precincts and sample ballots and all the different layers that were discussed. And it's a pretty cool tool. My question on the voter lookup is, do we feel good about where we're at on the voter lookup for the election? Good.
Yeah, it's been a work in progress. It's not 100% ideal, although Hannah, through our cooperation together, there's a lot of different ballot styles, and to try to make it as easy for voters as possible,
She came up with a solution, and I don't think we could have done anything better. So she did a great job in guiding me and helping me along the way. And it might take a little bit of getting used to and figuring out what you need to do on there, but we're always a phone call away if somebody has questions.
Down to 12?
Down to 12. Man, we made it that far.
Yeah.
And number 12, it's very simple. Haley and I discussed about, you know, this specifically, and really just continued support from all parties, you know, through the BOCC, our clerk, IT, the Secretary of State, having everybody on the same page and working together as a team is ideal. We're a county and we're elections, I guess, since I got to include Secretary McGrain up there. You know, it's a horse of a different color working in elections, and we just need to continue doing it together and being a team. So thank you.
Secretary, do you have any closing remarks?
I think the Secretary would agree, is particularly here in Canyon County, with as complex as it is, there is really no such thing as a perfect election. And a prior Secretary of State said it very often, pray for wide margins. And we do the best we can. Particularly, you know, when we come out with the new lines and whatnot, and the interior is usually, that's fine. It's those perimeter lines where we run into problems and some of the insets and whatnot that we have. So there's been a lot of checking that's gone on, and particularly on the perimeters that I'm talking about. So we're reasonably confident. Is it perfect? Well, it's possible that it's not.
Work, do you have any comments?
No, I appreciate the time dedicated to this today.
Yep. Yes, thanks for taking time during your harvest season, so I appreciate it. I think it's important that the public is aware and try to make it as transparent as we possibly can for them. So appreciate your attendance. We'll keep plugging along.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman, Commissioners.
Thank you, Secretary.
Thank you, Secretary.
Thanks, Bill.
Got a wave from way down here.
Adjourned.